Welcome, all you listeners. We hope that this will be an enlightening and maybe important discussion. I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now surrounding kind of the ag economy, the challenges that we're seeing in the ag economy, and the farm bill and what federal policy will look like. Not a lot of discussion, lots of focus on things other than agriculture in Washington, D.C. By way of introduction, I'm Heidi Heitkamp, former senator from the great state of North Dakota, but maybe more importantly, grew up in a town of 90 people, small farming community. Both of my grandparents were small family farmers, and my husband actually was raised and spent a lot of time on his family farm. And so this is in our blood. And Alliant Group is just such an important part of, we hope, providing advance or at least some more financial stability for American farmers and American the people who live in rural America. And so I'm grateful to be here with my friend and colleague, Mike Johanns. We got to be great friends when I joined the Senate. And of course, he was a seasoned leader already. And of course, I flocked to him because when you looked across the Senate, when I was there, there was no one who knew more about agriculture than Mike Johanns. And so it's an honor to be with you today, Mike.
Heidi, the feeling, as you know, is mutual. Just in terms of background, I grew up a couple states south of Heidi in the great state of Nebraska. Had a long career there, started as county commissioner and was mayor of Lincoln, governor of Nebraska. George W. asked me if I would be his ag secretary, so I went back to Washington for that, and then served a term in the United States Senate. And Heidi, we focused on agriculture, and I have to tell you, as I think about everything that's been going on the last couple of years with the Farm Bill, with the new administration, I don't think I've ever seen a more uncertain time in terms of ag policy. So maybe a great place to start the discussion is to talk about some things that happened at the end of the year. And then I'm going to toss it over to you to offer some insight into where we're at with Farm Bill and talk us through where you think that might be headed. But first of all, right at the end of the year, an assistance package, an emergency spending package was passed. And that's going to have some impact in farm country. So what does that mean? Well, about $31 billion was set aside in that package for a variety of things, about $20 billion for real disasters. You know, they had a lot of flooding in North Carolina, but any disaster across the country prior to the end of the year in agriculture is going to get a piece of that $20 billion. Then senators and House members, recognizing that things were pretty tough in ag country, went ahead and added $10 billion, which will be allocated pretty quickly here. I think the goal is to have it out the door in February, early March. And that will provide some needed financial assistance. So farmers can be expecting that if they raise corn, soybeans, wheat, et cetera, that they should get some financial assistance there. Now, we were all hoping that there would be a farm bill, but Heidi, what happened at the end of the year? No farm bill.
That just, I mean, honestly, it is wrapped around the wheels, not because of the farm bill. I think there's always disagreements about how much should we put in conservation? How do we balance this with nutrition? What are the kinds of new programs for biofuels? I mean, you know, these are not partisan issues. They tend to be regional issues more than partisan issues, which is probably why Mike and I get along so well, because we've come from soybean and corn country. We don't grow a lot of cotton and peanuts in our neck of the woods. But I think that what has held it up has been the overall kind of allocation of prioritization in the American budget. And, you know, that not having certainty on what we call the mark, or not knowing for sure what what the direction is in terms of overall spending, that's really held it up. And then there's always and I may sound a little judgmental, but there's always those groups in the House, the Freedom Caucus, many of whom have never voted for a farm bill. And so the farm bill as a necessity in the House needs to be bipartisan, especially when you only have a 2-vote majority or a 3-vote majority, because there's people who will never, in the Republican side, who will never vote for a farm bill. And so I think they're trying to work through that. I think we will have more clarity once the reconciliation kind of budget process begins and we know. But the bottom line is, it's not for lack of leadership, because I know, yeah, as does Mike, both Senator Bozeman and Senator Klobuchar. I know Amy Craig really well, had a great opportunity to meet GT. These are ag leaders who head up the Senate and House committees, who are really committed to getting this done and committed to coming to the table and negotiating. So the bad news is, you're hung up on a broader dialogue in Washington on budgets. The good news is, you have great leadership, I think, both bipartisan on both sides, bicameral leadership, who wants to get a farm bill done this year.
We are reading a lot these days about reconciliation and the big plans for a reconciliation bill and doing tax relief, this, that, and the next thing. Let me ask you, as people are reading that, do you see any possibility, any legal path forward to do the farm bill through reconciliation?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that right now, and just for everyone's kind of benefit, reconciliation is a unique process. It has to be budget aligned and budget related. I think that the farm bill has a number of priorities that may not qualify. And so, as Elizabeth McDonough, who is the parliamentarian of the Senate, she makes those decisions on whether something, you know, follows the so-called bird rule. She gives it a bird bath and decides what's in and what's out. I think it would be really hard to do the farm bill exclusively in reconciliation and get a good farm bill that sets good rural and farm policy moving forward.
So you've set the stage in the House. There's about 40 Republican House members. They didn't come to Washington to pass $1.5 trillion dollar spending package, which is really what the farm bill is all about.
Yeah.
So the only path I see forward in the House is a bipartisan path, where you have to reach out to Democrats, go across the aisle, and get a bipartisan bill. Am I reading that wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right. That's been the reality of the farm bill for literally, really since Freedom to Farm was transitioned into more kind of safety net that involved crop insurance, all of those things. That's the beginning of this kind of alliance between, you know, pro-Democrat nutrition people and people on the Republican side who want to make sure that we have rural policy. Because so much of the farm bill, Mike, you know, and I know, it's not just about what happens on the farm. It's what happens in rural communities, whether it's rural development, rural water, the electrification movement, broadband, E15, biofuels. So much of that farm bill is where we really examine rural policy. And that rural policy, in order for it to be achieve the certainty of 5 years, it's good that it's bipartisan. It's been bipartisan. I don't know how many farm bills you did. I did 2 farm bills when I was there. Proud of both of them. In fact, this 18 farm bill, which has been extended, is the one that we're operating under right now. And so the farm bill, the farm bill is not controversial in and of itself, except within the Freedom Caucus. But what it is if relationships urban rural, if relationships Democrat Republican sour, it's harder to get a farm bill. And so the harder those relationships turn, the more difficult it is to deliver good policy for rural America.
So to put a finer point on this and to put a bow on this package we call the Farm Bill, let's turn our attention to the Senate for a second.
Yeah.
If we can't do this by reconciliation, which is, as you know, that process allows you to do certain things by majority vote, then it looks to me like the only way to get a farm bill done, if you can't do it by reconciliation, is regular order. And that means 60 votes because you have a filibuster in the Senate. So there's 53 Republicans, there's 47 Democrats or people who caucus with Democrats. So at the end of the day, are we looking at a bipartisan process to get that 60 vote hurdle overcome?
Well, I had a chance. I was just in Washington and spent some time with Amy Klobuchar, who is the new ranking member. I didn't get a chance to see John Bozeman, but she felt very optimistic. And they, you know, the thing about Senator Bozeman, and you know it and I know it, he's just a really good guy. He's not a partisan. He's somebody who wants to get his job done. Amy is equally has a reputation for working across the aisle. She's got mad negotiating skills, and that may require some negotiating with her own caucus, as is true for Senator Bozeman. But, you know, I've said this, Mike, that, you know, the Farm Bill, because of how Republican rural America has become, the Farm Bill should really be among the highest Republican priority. And Democrats, especially in my neck of the woods, really care deeply about the Farm Bill. So I think that if you said, who do you have greater hope for to deliver a Farm Bill, the Senate or the House, I would tell you the Senate.
Yeah. So you've mentioned Amy Klobuchar, who we both know. We served with Amy. She is now the ranking member in the Senate. Talk a little bit about what she brings to the table. And then we have a new ranking member on the House side, also from Minnesota.
Yeah.
So if you could talk about the ranking members in the House and the Senate, and then maybe I'll offer a thought or two about John Bozeman, because he is now the new chairman of the Senate Ag Committee. And of course, G.T. Thompson is, he's still serving. He was chair in the last 2-year cycle. But talk a little bit about the leadership on the House and Senate side for Democrats.
Yeah. Well, let's start out with the House and Representative Craig. First off, everybody should understand that was a contested race for that leadership spot on agriculture. Representative Scott was reelected, would like to have served another term as ranking member, and was challenged by Representative Craig, and Craig prevailed. And she brings new energy to kind of what I think was maybe a stalled process, where it just seems like there was just too many hurdles to overcome. And so to me, when you become a new ranking member, you got to be listening to all of your membership, right? And the membership on the House side part of the House side is heavily invested in rural America. These are some of the few rural Democrats left, people who represent rural parts of our country, and they want to get a farm bill done. So there is a high level of interest in resolving. And that's not true for all committees. I know a lot of people would say, well, isn't that how it always is? No, I mean, there's a lot of people who serve on committees so that they can exercise one answer, and that's no. I don't think that's what we're going to see coming out of the House. So we'll see how her negotiating skills stack up and how she's able to, after they figure out, you know, kind of what they can work with, how she can, in fact, maneuver what I think will be a counteroffensive against the nutrition title. Amy is probably, I think if you went back and looked at Klobuchar's record, she would be one of the most prolific bipartisan delivers. She's never afraid to walk across the aisle, sit down, and get a deal done. She recognizes that the job of Congress is to get something done. And I think she has the ability. She's been in Democratic leadership for a lot of years, and she has the ability to really carry her caucus, that kind of leadership, similar to Debbie's. And so I think that those people, you know, I love Debbie. Debbie's one of my dear friends. Amy's one of my dear friends. But I will tell you that Amy will be a tough negotiator, but a fair negotiator. And her goal is to get to yes.
Yeah. So let me talk a little bit about John Bozeman. You and I both served with John Bozeman. John comes out of the great state of Arkansas. So you have to imagine he's going to pay attention to Southern crops. And John is just a good guy, as you've pointed out. He's not there to throw grenades. He's not there to get a one-upsmanship on somebody else. His job is to deliver. His job is to go there, do the hard work, participate in the committee process, do the legislation, and get a farm bill done. J.T. Thompson, much the same way. Very serious-minded guy. It's important to keep in mind that actually his farm bill proposal did come out of committee, somewhat bipartisan. I think he got two or three Democrats to vote for it. Now, having said that, I think you and I would both agree that the bill that came out of committee, authored by G.T. Thompson, wasn't going to become law. Yeah. Because he didn't have Republican votes. He had done some things on the nutrition side of the farm bill that didn't set well with Democrats. So that bill wasn't going to get passed. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think GT knew it. I think he had maybe hoped that he would be able to carry some of the Freedom Caucus people forward so that he could deliver a farm bill. That would have put a lot of pressure, I think, on Debbie over at the Senate, a lot of pressure on who at the time was the chair, you know. So I think when you look at these proposals, they're always a work in progress, and eventually there has to be the reconciliation between the House version and the Senate version, because as I said, the Senate version needs 60 votes. There is going to be a lot of negotiation about that nutrition title against reference prices. And I know, Mike, you've been following the reference price debate. So if you look at what are the anticipated changes in this farm bill, or where's the hangups? Hangup is in nutrition and probably reference prices, don't you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think nutrition is a big one. You know, there was some progress made from the viewpoint of Democrats during the Vilsack administration during his time as Ag Secretary. And they just simply don't want to give that up. So finding the sweet spot there and then finding the sweet spot for reference prices, I think, is the key piece of farm bill negotiations.
Well, and if I can just kind of not necessarily transition, but add a finer point to this, those of us who follow the farm economy see a lot of headwind. And it's not just commodity prices, dollar values, you know, markets, a more competitive international market, you know, commitment to biofuel. I mean, we could go through the whole list of what challenges farmers today. High input costs, you know, high energy costs mean high input costs for farmers. But you add the threat potentially of tariffs, and you add extreme weather on top of that. And, you know, I think there's some urgency. I just want to put a point on this. There's some urgency to getting this farm bill done because there's so much economic uncertainty right now for American producers.
Yeah. Boy, Heidi, you mentioned a key word there, the T word, tariffs. Talk through that. Conventional wisdom when we were in the Senate, when I was Ag Secretary, always was that in trade, there were two words that went together, tariffs and retaliation, that whoever imposed tariffs, whether it was another country on our products or us imposing tariffs on their products, there would be retaliation. Why in farm country and ranch country do farmers and ranchers worry so much about tariffs and the impact on their livelihood? What's driving that?
What's driving that is that if they aren't exporting, they're not profitable. And so when you put extra burden on your, let's go back to the first Trump term where we saw retaliation in soybeans, we saw retaliation in corn. And the Trump administration basically subsidized farmers for that loss of market. The market came back somewhat. Not completely, but I think there was this, okay, we've got an adjustment. The question is, at what point when you threaten a market or you put an artificial additional cost on American exports, at what point do you lose? And we are in a position, and you're better off to probably talk about this, Mike, given how much trade work that you've done, but take a look what's happening in Brazil. Take a look what's happening in Argentina. China building ports there saying, okay, you know, maybe we won't rely on American corn and soybeans. Maybe we can go to Central and South America. These are all kinds of long-term effects. And everybody kind of looks at the day-to-day market. And my concern about tariffs and retaliation is how do they divert or deviate long-term the potential for growth of American agricultural product marketing internationally?
Yeah, you know, Heidi, I would like to offer a thought or two here. Last year, I was in Brazil twice, and they are about 15% into their soybean harvest, literally as we speak, a little bit behind last year. But by anyone's definition, this was a perfect soybean year for Brazil. They got adequate rain, the crop got in on a timely basis, and so they are harvesting a huge crop. They don't have the storage capacity that we would have here in the United States, so that crop is going to go into the marketplace. And the pressure that that is going to put on the United States is going to be significant. Literally, as we start planting, we're going to have to find a home for a very, very large Brazil crop somewhere in the world. So, as you point out, one of the things that has happened is China, which initially bought virtually all of their soybeans from the United States, have looked to Brazil. So you've got that complicating factor. If you add on to that trade disputes and tariffs and retaliation, this thing could get very, very difficult for farmers and ranchers very quickly. In the states where we come from, corn, soybeans, beef, pork, just huge items that we need to find a marketplace for. And so if somebody is putting us at a disadvantage with a retaliatory tariff, that's serious. So this is real. And as this rolls out, it becomes very, very concerning for farmers and ranchers. The other point that is really important to make, so tariffs don't have to be linked to the same commodity, as you know, and retaliation can occur in a totally different commodity. So let's say we have a 25% tariff on steel and aluminum. Well, some country that exports a lot of steel and aluminum to the United States says, well, we're going to put tariffs on your farm products. And so there you go. They don't have to be linked to the same commodity. Literally, they can pick out any commodity they want and put a retaliatory tariff on it. So this is going to play out in the weeks and months ahead, but no wonder that our constituents in farm and ranch country are concerned.
Yeah, and you know, not to belabor it, but there was a study done about the revenue that was raised in the first Trump term from tariffs, and they measured that against what was necessary to make farmers whole as a loss of markets. And pretty much, I think 90% of the revenue that was generated from tariffs went back to agriculture. Are we going to see that level of commitment again to make farmers whole? And my point is, and you know, that the last thing American farmers want is a check in the mailbox. I know there's a lot of people out there who may groan when they hear that, but they understand that when you're dependent on the federal government, you're dependent on the federal government. They'd rather be dependent on themselves and their marketing, their ability to market their product, because long term, that's sustainable, not government, you know, subsidies.
Heidi, as long as we're taking on topics like Farm Bill, tariffs, why don't we just jump right into immigration
Oh, goody.
and
Goody.
talk
That
about
we're
that?
solving all the tough ones today.
Yeah. You've read this report. It's gotten a lot of attention that 40% of the workforce in agriculture is undocumented. I don't know of a single farmer or rancher that is happy about that report. Labor in farm country is desperately needed, but every farmer and rancher wants to do it the right way, wants to do it legally, wants to make sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. But as this issue ramps up and we see deportations, raids, et cetera, talk to me about the impact that that will have, whether it's packing plants or agriculture production, dairy farms, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I mean, the first thing I think you need to take a look at it as what's the short-term implications of what's happening today? The fear factor, people not showing up for work, not picking the strawberries. What does that mean for grocery store prices? What does that mean for farmers who rely on those workers to basically, you know, get the capital to produce the next crop? I mean, you know, this is a labor intensive, especially in fruits and vegetables, labor intensive kind of business. And even our growers, I mean, we have tons of workers who come from other places that help harvest in even in North Dakota and Nebraska. And so, you know, the farm worker crisis was there even before we had this fear factor and people staying home. So now we've got kind of an immediate challenge that's challenging a lot of our smaller, you know, vegetable and fruit farmers. People who pick these crops aren't showing up. Crops are rotting in the field. So that's a huge challenge. But I think longer term, how do we finally achieve a rational immigration policy? Because all we're talking about right now is deportation. When I think you were there when we did the immigration bill, weren't you, Mike?
Yes,
Yeah.
I
So
was.
almost 70 senators voted for that bill because they knew that there had to be. I mean, and there were consequences for people who came into this country illegally, but it also recognizes that you know, the cost and the economically to our economy, but also to the budget of exporting or deporting a bunch of people is not maybe the wisest way to move forward. And yes, everybody should agree that anybody who has committed a crime in this country needs to find their way back from where they came from, should never have been allowed in this country. But beyond that, when you look at just in your case, talking about 40% of the workforce, 20 to 25% of the construction industry are people who are undocumented. What does that mean for a housing shortage problem that we have, housing crisis that we have? I mean, when we can't find people who will do the sheetrocking, can't find people who will go on the roof and you know, shingle. And so these the real, I think, casualty in all of this is once again hardening positions that will result in not getting finality and decisions made that need to be made in the immigration space.
Yeah, the big issue, I think, whether it's construction, whether it's dairy farmers, specialty crops, where so much hand labor is involved, the big issue is people want a certain process whereby they can hire somebody and know that they are legally protected in making that hiring decision. The current system, where there is just so many people who are utilizing papers that aren't legal, that were, you know, made up somewhere along the line, doesn't work. And it's not a long-term solution to the needs of our country.
But I also would say, any of you out there who know anybody who wants to move to a dairy farm in Minnesota and milk cows, send them that way. I mean, there's this idea, well, they're taking American jobs. Well, I mean, I think that if dairy farmers could hire people that they had certainty were operating and working in this country legally, that's who they would hire.
Well, we're probably running out of time here. So let me toss something over to you and then I'll take a shot at it. Let's say you're having a conversation with the new Ag Secretary, Brooke Rollins. And I do think she'll be confirmed probably this week. What's the two or three things you would tell her that are really important for agriculture in this country that definitely need to be on her to-do list?
On her, I mean, and this won't make her popular in the administration, but she needs to make trade one of her top priorities. Because I have a theory on how you should approach these jobs. You're gonna be dealing with all of the challenges of today. And there's plenty, you know, dollar values, commodities, you know, whether people will take our product because they don't like GMOs, whatever that is, whatever the barriers are to helping farmers. But her job isn't just to look today, it's to look up and say, what does American agriculture and rural America, because she's now the key point person for rural America. What does that look like? And what are these policies that have worked before that aren't working now? And how do I drive a narrative as the leader of rural policy, not just for American agriculture, but for the entire country? And so what I would say is, yes, be strategic about what's happening right now. Focus heavily for farmers on trade, because that is where the bread and butter will be. But look up for rural communities and think about the better way. I mean, as we're looking at refining how we spend money, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, but look up and say, what does rural America look like in 10 years? And how can I use my position to make sure that we have a vibrancy and a, you know, a connectivity of rural America to the rest of our country?
Yep. I'll just add a couple of thoughts to wrap up our conversation today. She's got a long list. When I think about the need to get a farm bill done, her leadership will be very, very important. She doesn't have to put a farm bill proposal out there, but I do believe that she has to be very engaged with leadership in the Senate and House to get this to the finish line and keep the White House on board. The second thing is, this situation with avian influenza, I find very, very worrisome.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden it goes from poultry to cows to humans. And obviously this virus is mutating and changing and adapting. And that should be concerning for everyone. And it's not just the price of eggs that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the real threat to health. Human health and animal health.
So I want not to catastrophize this thing even further. Pat Roberts, a dear friend of both of ours, who was chair of the Ag Committee my last couple of years when I was in the Senate, he did a hearing because Kansas has a center for basically agricultural bioterrorism. You know, and the other thing is, you know, we live in a really unsafe world. We rely a lot on imports for our agriculture, to not forget that role that USDA plays in inspecting and guaranteeing that we have a safe food supply. against enemies that would hurt us. And so that going to your aviate, to the bird flu, you know, that they're just, it's a complex agency, but yet it also is a wonderful opportunity for this young woman to lead rural America into the next iteration of prosperity and success. So I wish her all the luck in the world, and anything I can do to help her, I'm there for her.
Great. Heidi, it's always a pleasure. And to all of our listeners out there, it was great to offer some
I get
thoughts.
To ask one last question.
Okay.
We're going to do the bet, you know. Do we get a farm bill this year?
I think it's 50-50. Yeah. I really do. I'm a little bit pessimistic. I hope we do. I'm certainly advocating for it, but I think it's a coin toss at the moment.
I would have said 50-50, but damn, Amy was just so certain that she could get her done. So I'm betting on Amy. I'm saying
all right, great.
A little bit higher probability.
All righty. It's been a pleasure. Okay. And to all of our listeners, thank you.